better come on in my kitchen. There's fun to be ran out of. She won't come back. I'll take the last liquor out of her nation, sir. You better come on in my kitchen. There's country beer and I do.
Baby, can't you hear that wind howling? Oh, you can't you hear that wind howling?
You better come on in my kitchen. There's going to be rain and I do. When a woman gets in trouble, everybody throws her down. Looking for a good friend, none can be found. You better come on in my kitchen. There's going to be rain and I do. And a time coming, it's gonna be so. You can't make the winter be just dry long so. You better come on in my kitchen. This country be raining, I do.
That was Robert Johnson, and this is Richard Roth with The Passage on WGXC. My guest this month is Carter Radcliffe, the poet and art critic. I apologize for the quality of the audio. There was a rather raucous meeting going on next door. But you may have to strain slightly, but it will be well worth the effort, I assure you. Thank you. This is Richard Roth with The Passage on WGXC, and my guest is Carter Radcliffe. Welcome.
Yes, thank you.
You're going to be having a reading this Saturday.
Saturday, right.
At CR10.
CR10.
And that will be your poetry?
Yes. Yes, although I'm not sure yet. I may read something from my novel, but I haven't decided.
And actually, you have three types of writing: the novel, the poetry, and art criticism.
Right.
And did you start with which came first?
Poetry. Poetry came first, and that led directly to writing about art. When I came to New York, in the late 60s because the poets I was interested in were all there. And when I got there and got to know the poets, I found out that many of them were involved with the art world. They were friends of painters and sculptors. And a number of them were writing about art. There was a magazine, Art News, which in those days recruited a lot of its reviewers from the ranks of poets. And so I just sort of casually started doing that, writing small reviews, and that led fairly quickly to full-time writing about art.
On staff or as a freelancer?
As a freelancer,
I see.
Yeah. Well, there was a category on the masthead. It was called Editorial Associate, and that was my title at Art News. And then I wrote for Art International and Art Forum, a number of other magazines, but that's where I began, with Art News.
And who were the poets who drew you to New York?
Well, the older ones, which I thought of as the kind of the leaders, included John Ashbery, and there was Kenneth Koch, Jimmy Schuyler. One of them was Frank O'Hara, who was a very, very important figure on the scene, although he had been killed in an automobile accident just the year before, so I never got to meet him. But his spirit pervaded that world, and especially important to some of the younger poets like Ted Berrigan, whom I got to know, and Ann Waldman and Lewis Warsh. And there was a whole second generation of those poets in New York.
I read some of Frank O'Hara's criticism and poetry, actually.
Yeah, well, he was one of the main, in fact, of that generation, though John Ashbery was at Art News. He was one of the editors, along with Betsy Baker and a few others. He was the one who sort of had the job of finding younger poets who'd be willing to write those small reviews. And the idea was that if you were a poet, you could probably write. It wasn't so important that you knew anything about art. It was kind of on-the-job training. In fact, I didn't have any background in art. I was an English major, and I didn't study art history. So when I started doing it seriously, I had to do a lot of catching up. You know, there was a lot of, as I say, on-the-job training that I had to figure out how to do, because I, you know, you were really sort of thrown into it and you're on your own. And I, you know, a number of the poets did it for a while, and then they realized they weren't that interested in art. But I was interested, very.
And at that time, the sort of leading lights of the New York art world?
Oh, well, it was a very interesting time. It was the late 60s. That world of Frank O'Hara and Jimmy Schuyler and John Ashbery, that was the world of the abstract expressionists. They were young in the 50s. And by the end of the 60s, a lot had happened. Pop art had happened. Minimalism had happened. And minimalism had morphed into all sorts of things, ranging from conceptual art to earthworks. So there was and performance art, video art, there was an endless array of things going on. It's hard to say what was prominent. It was such a turbulent time. I'd say earthworks, Robert Smithson and Robert Morris and all that was extremely lively. It was interesting, though. They were way out in the desert in the far west, and nobody actually saw them. Well, Betsy Baker actually went to see them. But I've never been to see them. So they existed mostly as documentation. And that was an interesting thing that was going on. I mean, where is the art? You know, what is the art experience? Minimalism had raised that question, too. You know, it's so highly conceptualized. Is it in thinking about it? Is it in the experience of it? All those things were up for grabs at the time. So it was extremely interesting. And that continued into the 70s, all that very fast-paced development.
And at that time, Soho was just kind of in its beginnings, I think.
Just beginning, yeah. The main Soho building was 420 West Broadway. That opened up in 1972. But by then, Soho had become really equal to 57th Street, the former main drag of the art world. And so I think that must have started in 68, 69.
And did you have any particular artists that you followed or attended to, as it were?
Well, even though it was from an earlier period, Jackson Pollock and Willem de Kooning and the Abstract Expressionists were very important to me.
And then you wrote a book on Pollock, didn't you?
Yeah, it was a book about Pollock and not exactly his influence, but his example, because his way is really a new way of making a painting, I think it's hard to avoid the word influence, although all the people I wrote about denied that they were influenced by Pollock, but the example of how to make a painting, how to make an image or an artwork that rather than being contained within the frame is implicitly infinite, that it could go on and on forever. Some of the earthworks people seem to be Pollock's heirs in that respect, that they would go out and do things. Of course they have to be their objects, their whatever they are, huge heaps of rock and stone, have limits. They're not literally infinite, but there's no principle within them that implies closure. So that in a way they were doing something, they were sort of making a gesture in the desert that was sort of at one with the immensity of the desert, which feels infinite if you're in the middle of it. And that seems all to have been implied in Pollock. So that's what the book was about, tracing that possibility as it worked out in minimalism. Because the minimalist grid, for example, of course it can't go on forever. It has to be contained within the studio. But there's nothing in a grid that says this is where it has to stop, or this is where it would make it seem balanced or composed. And that's what Pollock did away with, that notion of compositional closure. And it seemed to have a lot to do not just with developments in aesthetics and various art forms, but it seemed to have something to do with the kind of American spirit of endless expansion and endless optimism, endless... I trace it back to Whitman and even Emerson, you know, that feeling of... That America is endlessly, has an endless potential, and there's a darker side to that. But I mean, there's an optimistic version of that, and then there's a darker side that perhaps has come out in recent years more than previously, but. But I think there's something, and when Europeans who paid attention to art first saw Pollock, they realized this is something strange, this is something new. Many of them didn't like it. Of course, many Americans didn't and still don't like Pollock, you know. But I'm talking about people in Europe who were very much part of either the Italian or the French art world, and they thought that this is barbarous or meaninglessness, just asserting itself in some way that they didn't like. Because there was a big show in 1958 that the Museum of Modern Art put on. In retrospect, it seems pretty clear that it was part of a Cold War initiative. I mean, the Soviet Union was sending all sorts of ballerinas and everyone else, piano players, to the West to show that they were highly cultured. And so America... the American institutions, including the CIA, as it turns out, reciprocated with exhibitions, performers, literary types that were sent abroad to convince the world that America is not just this, you know, capitalist behemoth, but a place of culture and innovation and so on. And so this big show in 58, New American Painting, traveled to 8 cities in Europe. And it had an extraordinary impact. Both people were astonished. Some, as I say, hated it. Some of it. Some were fascinated by it. And it had an influence. There's a whole development in Italian painting called Informale that seems to be a response to what they saw, not just in Pollock, but in all the abstract expressionist gestural painting.
And that was really when... America kind of took the lead.
Yeah. That really put the stamp on America's preeminence in the visual arts, which was never absolute. There were always interesting European artists, but the New York art world especially was so convinced of its own significance and its own centrality to everything that for decades they didn't pay attention to art from anywhere else, including art from Los Angeles or Chicago. You know, it was in an odd way provincial, kind of a provincialism of the capital. That changed in the 80s. There were a number of lively young European painters who suddenly showed up in New York, and that changed things. Not so much from Italy, but from Germany earlier. Germans like Baselitz, who'd been around for a long time, began to be noticed in New York and to be influential. You know, there was something called neo-expressionism, which was not carrying on from abstract expressionism. It was a kind of a mixture of American and European impulses that I suppose the great exemplar of that in America would be Julian Schnabel. You know, the main neo-expressionist. It's a kind of a wobbly term, but it did mark a new atmosphere in the New York art world.
And did the galleries kind of take the lead?
Yes, in fact, I remember people saying that the galleries had become, well, not just galleries, but collectors had become perhaps more important than they had been before in determining which artists were significant. Starting in the late 30s, there were in New York, there were a number of very influential critics, and there was an idea that it was critics who were the main referees, so to speak, of in the game, you know, saying who was victorious and who wasn't. But and this leads, starting in the 80s, it leads to the situation we have now, where the market heats up, and collectors, in a certain way, encouraged by dealers, kind of bypass critical opinion to go straight to whatever they like, you know, and that's led to this hyper inflated market that we have now. You know. I mean, that was always, people sort of thought that had begun to happen with pop art, because many critics who considered themselves serious thought that pop art was not serious. But that didn't stop pop art from becoming extremely prominent and influential. And I think they were wrong. I think that especially Warhol were extremely important artists. You know. Not that there aren't things to be dubious about in public. He was Warhol. He's a very complex character and a very uneven artist, but he was extremely important. Not, people will say, well, Jeff Koons and Damien Hirst are just Warhol on steroids, but in fact they're not. They're nowhere near as complex and interesting and subtle as Warhol was. There's this kind of veneer of superficiality that in itself is interesting.
Well, he was actually a very good draftsman.
Yes, he was. He was. He, well, during the 50s, he had a very successful career as a commercial artist. He was very productive. He wasn't especially original. There was an artist called Ben Shahn who, from the 30s. You know.
I remember him, sure.
Yeah. Who was, he had a graphic style, it was kind of a wiry line, and it looked very, very intense and charged. Even though it was very spare, it seemed charged with a lot of feeling. And there were any number of, by the 50s, there were any number of young graphic artists and commercial illustrators who picked up on that. And Warhol was one of them. But if you know, when you have an artist like Warhol and he has a sort of earlier career, all the early stuff that he tried to bury gets brought out and shown, and you realize he was extremely talented within that rather limited sphere and very successful as a commercial artist. But he always wanted to be a fine artist. And he had trouble doing it. I mean, he couldn't get Leo Castelli, who was the premier dealer then, to pay attention to him, because Castelli by then had already taken on, this is the early 60s, had already taken on Roy Lichtenstein, and he thought, well, he doesn't need another pop artist. And probably didn't like Warhol as much as he liked Lichtenstein anyway. But he finally prevailed through the intervention of Castelli's director, a man named Ivan Karp, who left Castelli in the late 60s to open up one of the first Soho galleries.
OK Harris,
yeah. And he was in Soho before Castelli was, in fact. He moved ahead of Castelli in that respect. But that was part of the mix of the 60s, and there are things that people don't think about so much anymore that made a big splash at the time, like op art, for example. Very few artists have survived from op artists have survived. Bridget Riley is one of them, and I can hardly think of any others. But that had a very powerful impact in the middle of the 60s. And the intensity of the critical discussion, I think, led from the sparseness of the minimalist object, which was heavily theorized, to the idea that art could be a text, you know, that it, I mean, people wouldn't say visual art at that point, but they would just say art, I think there's not a very solid foundation for that development, but it was very important at the time because it forced people to back on their assumptions. I mean, well, if a typewritten page on the wall isn't art, as many people thought, then what is art? You know, and if it's a matter of a concept, then why shouldn't it be a typewritten page on the wall? You see, so there were, all that was all, none of it was ever settled, but it produced a lot of really interesting art.
Where did you come from?
I grew up in the Great Lakes region. I lived near Detroit and Cleveland and Toledo. I went to the University of Chicago. So that's part of the world I came from. Well, that part of the world is now called the Rust Belt. But when I was growing up, it was called the Industrial Heartland of America. You know, it was long before the 70s and the problem with Japanese automobiles being better than American automobiles. And there was this because this was not so long after the Second World War. And in fact, it was that part of the world, and not just Detroit, but any number of cities, including Pittsburgh, but not a Great Lakes city, but nearby and important for steel production. It was the extraordinary mobilization of that industrial plant that tipped the balance in the Second World War. I mean, that's why the North won the Civil War, too. I mean, just could outlast the other side, which was fortunate. I mean, it could have gone the other way, you know, very easily. And it took an extraordinary amount of effort and dedication and just sheer will to mobilize that industrial force to produce the munitions and the equipment that were essential to ultimately winning the war. And that feeling, I mean, people didn't talk about it in those terms, but that feeling of accomplishment, that feeling of self-confidence that it brought with it, you know, that victory, and that in that part of the world, that contribution to the victory was part of the atmosphere that I grew up in. This is the Eisenhower years, you know, this notion of America triumphant and stable and self-confident and sure of, I mean, none of this turned out to be true, but in the long run, and the car companies, which were at the heart of it, of that industrial success, became complacent and by the mid-70s were in really serious trouble, which we're still feeling. I mean, it only got worse, really. But so I sort of feel that too is part of where I'm from, that atmosphere, whether or not it was entirely justified, that sort of sense of America's centrality, America's triumph, and so on. On the other hand, it wasn't entirely congenial to me. It didn't seem to have a lot of room for the things that interested me. I mean, poetry and ultimately art and so on. So that's why I left that part of the world and ended up in New York, which was a very different place then. I just read a piece by Robert Morris, who sort of an autobiographical piece, sort of musing about his development over the years. And he was talking about the 60s, how he came from Missouri, Kansas City, Missouri, by way of the West Coast, where he went to school. He He said I remember this. I mean, he said that in New York in the 60s there was slack in the system. So, you know, there were parts of even Manhattan that weren't particularly well developed. They weren't all that desirable from a real estate investment point of view. They were just sort of hanging on. And in those marginal places, artists could find artists and poets and, you know, people who were not engaged in what you might call normal careers could survive.
Right, rents were low enough that you could be a writer or something.
Yeah, yeah. And they were kind of astonishingly low. I mean, those he lived farther downtown when he was referring to living on Chambers Street, but which is down near City Hall, but Soho, which is a little farther uptown, was very similar. These 19th century buildings that were left over, there many of them didn't have elevators, and there was no commercially viable reason to give them elevators, and if they didn't have elevators, they weren't really fit for modern commerce. So they were just sitting there, and landlords were hanging on to them, and they were happy in the early 60s to rent a 3,000 square foot space for $100, $80 a month. You know, it's remarkable. No. And that was very, very important for that decade of innovation and you could even say aesthetic turmoil that I was talking about, the 60s, that artists could live that way and be free. Now it seems, I mean, maybe this is a bit of a caricature, but even in school, artists seem to be taught about how to deal with the market, how to put together a resume, how to sort of brand and market themselves, and they're oriented toward finding a spot in a gallery right away. I mean, in the 60s, the more interesting artists were pursued by the galleries. I mean, the galleries were inventing themselves in relationship to people like Robert Morris or Robert Smithson or Richard Serra, you know, there was more of an even relationship between the artist and the gallery. I mean, ultimately, it's all a marketplace, and that can't be forgotten, but it's a matter of how much commercial pressure there is, you know. In Soho, eventually, that became a very stylish place, fashionable place, and all these garment manufacturers decided they had to have a flagship shop there, like Prada and Dolce & Gabbana and so on. And they were driven out. The galleries were driven out because these big corporate enterprises could pay much more rent. And, of course, the landlords accepted that or encouraged it, marketed their spaces as it's interesting. I mean, it's those shops in Soho, I'm sure, add a statistically negligible amount to the bottom line of those big fashion outfits. I mean, you never see anybody in there. Nobody really shops in those places, and yet they have to be there. It's sort of like if you're a nation, you have to be in the United Nations. I mean, it's an institutional demand. It doesn't. It all has to do with things that one would hope art wouldn't have anything to do with, but maybe started to have more to do with this notion of branding and marketing and so on.
Was that kind of a gradual thing, or how did that?
Well, I think it was. I'm not sure. That would be interesting, sort of the history of commerce, to know which of those high-end outfits saw that it would be prestigious and stylish and hip to have presence in Soho. But once it began to happen, it happened very quickly. They started piling in. And then Chelsea happened. There's I don't know it very well, there's an obscure sort of story of real estate development that goes into the appearance of those Chelsea galleries, which there was a time when the Chelsea rents were lower than the Soho rents, but now they're very high, so now you have a migration. Well, long before that, this recent development, younger galleries would set up in Brooklyn and so on. But this recent development I'm talking about is the galleries that are opening up on the Lower East Side.
Sort of over toward the Bowery in that way.
Yeah, yeah. So, you know, you could write a history of art as a history of a marketplace. But I think the difficulty now, or the challenge now, is to try to find what's interesting in art that isn't simply a reflection of a market-shaped taste, you know. I think it's perfectly possible to do that, but you have to somehow determine not to be so dazzled by by these extraordinary prices, whether they come out of the gallery or out of the market, out of the auction houses.
Now, Hudson, for example, is it still pretty dependent on New York City?
Well, I think the outposts of art here do have a relationship to New York, maybe some more than others. I don't know that it's a direct dependence, but I mean say the John Davis Gallery, I mean there are some artists in his gallery that have a New York connection and some that don't. And I don't really know who his collectors are, whether there are people who are active in New York and here. I guess I don't really know too much about that. It seems, though, that he and Carrie Haddad and some of the others are pretty independent. They can't be entirely independent, but that they've developed a pretty intense sort of local art world, you know. Still pretty small, but you know they're galleries that come and go.
How long have you been in this area?
Since 2003, we were living way downtown at the time of 9/11. We were really quite close to it, although where we were, because of the architecture, we couldn't see the World Trade Center, but we were close. And in the aftermath of that, we were on Beaver Street, which is in the financial district. The place became pretty uncongenial. There were people with automatic weapons and bomb-sniffing dogs and these long sticks with mirrors on the bottom at the end to check the underside of the vehicles. And then all sorts of concrete barriers put up. And it was, we didn't feel it was a place that we wanted to be anymore. So we left and we were familiar with the Hudson Valley and we liked it. So we came up here. We weren't absolutely determined in the very beginning that we were going to stay here, but we really like it so much that, we have stayed here. And now, and go back into New York fairly often, but this is kind of the center of our lives now.
And so you continue writing poetry and criticism here?
Yeah. It's possible, especially with all various kinds of technology that we have. I mean, I do go into town, you know, fairly often to look at art. You know, you don't have to be there every day. Don't have to commute. And there are lively things here. You know, I mean, there's a lot going on in Hudson and in the vicinity. You know.
I can't wait to go over to Williamstown for the Prado show.
Oh, yeah. I haven't seen that yet. The last thing I saw there was a show of, quite a while now, a show of David Smith sculptures. And they had a selection of abstract expressionist works at the time. The new edition was fairly new then, and I thought it was terrific, really wonderful.
I did a newspaper article when they were restoring a Pollock there, actually.
Uh-huh.
Very interesting.
Yeah.
Because they used all kinds of paint. And
yeah, yeah. And some of it wasn't proper fine art paint, you know, that he used commercial enamels and things. And I'm not sure that he prepared his canvases all that well. So there's always a problem of things just falling off. You know what I mean? Although they seem to have stood up pretty well, the ones that you see in the modern and at the Met. But maybe they've been preserved, you know, mm-hmm. carefully. They look.
Well, if it isn't a good visual record, it would be hard to know what had fallen off.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. I think that he's pretty well documented, because the thing with Pollock's way of making a painting, I think right from the very beginning, there developed this problem of imitators or outright fakes that, and because it looks as though it should be easy. And I've had people come to me and say, gee, I have this Pollock, you wrote this book about Pollock, because you know, and it looks nothing like a Pollock. I mean, it's just, you know, you can see why there's something very distinctive about the gestures he made, you know. It's not just enough to make loops of paint on the canvas. But there are others that are questionable.
Did you happen to see any of the many fakes that were sold through Nodler & Company?
No. I saw reproductions of them, and in reproduction they didn't look convincing. No, and it wasn't, you know, there were Motherwells, I think there were Rothko's maybe, I can't remember.
I think there was a Rothko too, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think they were pretty good fakes. There was somebody on Long Island who was making them, and he didn't realize what he was doing, as I understand it. He was told that he was making them for people who wanted to have, say, a Rothko or a Motherwell, but couldn't afford it, so this would be a kind of, you know, substitute. He was paid not very much for doing this, but he was pretty good. And so it's sort of plausible that all these fakes were sold. I don't really know the story very well. There's a great deal of that going on. And there's another problem, which is that there are probably real Pollocks out there that cannot get accepted as real Pollocks because the foundation at a certain point stopped certifying them or authenticating them. They stopped doing the authentication, and without that authentication, it can't be sold or accepted. It can't be accepted, and then it can't find a place in the market. So there's no museum or institution that will touch it without that certification. So there are these Pollocks, some of which I've seen, one in particular, that a lot of work was done, forensic work and so on, but the foundation was out of the authentication business by then and wouldn't certify it. And so it's in limbo. But it looks real to me, unlike many others that I've seen that don't.
Was he pretty prolific?
He was. There was a period, you know, he had this great reputation for being a heavy drinker and sort of an out-of-control drunk, really, which he was. But there was a period in the late, well, starting in 46, when Lee Krasner, his wife, who was also a painter, got him to lay off, and he was sober for about 3.5 years. And during that period, that's when he developed this method of painting. And he did a lot. He did a lot. And it's amazing, considering how repetitious, in a certain way, it is, how richly varied they are. It's just, it's extraordinary. Because you'd think at a certain point he'd start repeating himself, but he never did. You know. And then he went off the wagon in, I think, 1950. He continued, and he did some interesting paintings, but that three and a half year period that's the main thing. It's a very short, it's remarkable, really, considering how important they've been, those paintings, and the influence they've had, that it was just a really sustained burst of extraordinary invention and energy. Unlike de Kooning, who was a highly accomplished painter of a traditional kind, wielded a brush, wonderful draftsman, who was never satisfied with what he did, would work it and rework it, and went through, over a period of many decades, that's the sort of thing that art historians try to sort out, how many phases he had, but he had many, and there are major works in every phase. It's a completely different way of being an artist. It's a more traditional way, actually. You get proper training, which Pollock never really had. And de Kooning was an academically trained artist. And he really knew how to paint in the way, the traditional way, like Titian or Rembrandt or something. But in a modernist mode. And extraordinarily inventive, but in a different way. It's not that sort of ecstatic burst. It's a more deliberate kind of creativity. And they sort of recognized each other as opposite poles and respected each other and would kind of tease each other about, each would say the other wasn't really quite doing it the right way. You know?
Were they both out in the Springs at that time?
No. I'm not sure when de Kooning moved out there. He wasn't in Springs, but he was nearby, you know, that out in the Hamptons somewhere. I visited the studio once when he was very, very elderly. Amazing thing. It was like a ship that he built or something. It was extraordinary light and strange. It wasn't a squared away structure. It was all angles. And let's see, when did Pollock went out there? Oh, I think in 45, 46. And he was there until he was killed in the car crash in 56. I don't think de Kooning went out to the Hamptons until some point in the 60s. But it was somewhat for the same reason. Lee Krasner felt that New York, with all the bars and all his pals and everything, was a bad influence on him, and he couldn't get any work done, or he couldn't stay sober either. And de Kooning, one of his motives was that when he started to become recognized, which didn't happen right away, he had his first one-man show, and he was in his mid-40s, so that would be around in the late 1940s at some point. And then in the next 10 years, he became, with Pollock, the most celebrated artist of that group. And it was just, he just found himself plagued. I mean, he started having fans and things who would intrude on his time, you know. So that was one of the reasons he went out there. And also he said it was congenial. You know, he was from the Netherlands, and that flat landscape and the nearby water, that inspired one of his major phases, you know, those sort of, actually you could say, watery paintings that he started doing when he first moved out there. So that was that was a good move for him, you know, to get away from the... Because, in the 60s, it wasn't just Andy Warhol. I mean, artists were becoming celebrities, and de Kooning was one of them. And he didn't really want that. I mean, you know, he didn't mind, you know, being famous and all that. But there's a downside to it, you know, as if you're really serious about working all the time. And he kind of fled from that. And it didn't hurt his celebrity at all. You know, he continued to make wonderful paintings and be considered, our greatest painter and all that sort of thing, right up until the end, almost.
Is there anybody who sort of has that stature these days?
Well, no, it's a different kind of stature. I mean, people are famous for having auction records, I mean, that's not quite fair. I mean, there are artists who are taken seriously, but no, I don't think so. I mean, and I don't, one of the reasons is that the art world is too big for there to be that clear of focus on any one person or any one small, well-defined group of people. In the 60s, there were the old, you know, war horses, the abstract expressionists who were carrying on, most of whom had left town by that time, but they were known, they were showing all the time. And, you know, that was one thing that, in their different ways, the pop artists and the minimalists were working off against everything that the abstract expressionists stood for in very different ways, but there's a kind of shared motive there. But, okay, so you have the abstract expressionists, let's say that in the mid-60s, you have the pop artists and the minimalists. Well, these are small groups of artists. There were many other interesting artists who didn't want to fit into these groups, but they could be placed in relationship. I mean, you could sort of have a map in your head of, just as you could with the gallery scene, of artists and their relationship to each other. It was very interesting.
There were these Ad Reinhardt comics,
yes,
the
right.
Trees and branches.
Yeah, right, yeah. You could do that, and you could make up your own chart, too. I mean, it was manageable. But now it doesn't feel that manageable. I mean, there are tons of artists, and that I think they, just the sheer number of them throws things out of focus. Although, if I were just starting out now the way I was in the late 60s and going around to all the galleries all the time, I'm sure I'd have a clearer picture. But I think it would have that problem of just the sheer number of artists, just the immensity of the geography, either imaginative or actual. So much territory to cover, and there's such a variety of things going on.
Now, when it comes to poetry, do you have an area or a focus or?
You mean in my own poetry?
In your own poetry?
No, not exactly. I mean, I'm not sure exactly where my poetry comes from, but it's a poem usually starts with a fragment of language. And then goes from there in ways that I can't really anticipate. The other factor that's often in play is that if it's a fragment of language that I've found or maybe kept the same or maybe altered, it often has a source, either real or imaginary. So it's not necessarily my voice, but the voice of a character. So in a way, many of my poems are like dramatic monologues. The main figure there that people think of is Robert Browning, you know, with My Last Duchess and so on. But also T.S. Eliot, in effect, does dramatic monologues like Prufrock and Geronchon, and then there are many voices in The Wasteland, but none of them are exactly Eliot's. You know, that's a sort of a wide screen, whereas Prufrock or My Last Duchess of Browning, that's a focus, you know, a portrait of a single character, but that's often going on in my poetry, so I just sort of follow my sense of this person, presence. I mean, ultimately it's me, but it sort of goes through this other circuit, you know, and that for me, it enlivens the language. I know that there's a sort of a central idea about poetry as self-expression, a kind of immediate utterance of one's inward being. I don't think I've ever written that way. I think I've always written from a sense of language, and I mean, I must be in there somewhere, and it probably expresses something about me somehow, but that's not the primary motive. You know, it was important for me to find the poets in New York, because somehow, you know, when I was an English major, the poets, the contemporary poets, aside from Eliot, that were taken seriously in the years of Chicago, a very academic setting, were poets like Robert Lowell and John Berryman, Richard Eberhardt, Richard Wilbur. Poets that have virtues but that I thought were kind of dull. And that was a problem because I had this idea that I was a poet, but that there wasn't any contemporary poetry that really was interesting to me. I was very interested in the Romantic poets, late 18th, early 19th century poets, mostly English. So that was important to me, but it bothered me that there wasn't anybody contemporary that I really cared about. And Eliot was still alive then, but not... He didn't really seem to be a contemporary poet. I mean, The Wasteland is from 1923, I think. But I kept reading little magazines and looking here and there, and I discovered these poets, mostly in New York, and they seemed to be much livelier, much more interesting. And so and I think they are. I think I still feel that. And it turns out that they were themselves, especially the older ones, Kenneth Koch and John Ashbery, you know, in the 50s when they were young poets, they too felt this way about Robert Lowell and company, you know. I mean, Robert Lowell is a very accomplished poet and everything, but there's something kind of stiff and ultimately boring about him, I think. But anyway, it's a matter of taste, and I found myself... drawn to the New York poets, both the Ashbery generation and the younger sort of Ted Berrigan. One of the things that they did, which the more academic poets didn't do, they brought a sense of play into poetry, which is it wasn't unserious, but it sort of stirred things up in a way that a more self-consciously or deliberately serious attitude toward poetry couldn't do. For example, they would do collaborations. They would set up rules. And the simple rule, I'll write one line, then you write the next line. But then they made more elaborate rules, like every line has to name a color, some sort of vehicle, and a kind of bird, or, you know, something like that. And then they would see what happened. I mean, a lot of them were really silly. And didn't lead anywhere, but some of them were terrific. And these collaborations, and there's a magazine that published a whole batch of them, which I got to be familiar with. And the thing that it did was loosen everything up. It got outside a kind of serious, overly serious, kind of solemn idea of poetry to as I say, it brings a spirit of play into it, and once that happens, other things besides the great tradition can come into your poetry. Or you can, as a poet, be attentive to things beyond this rather solemn academic notion of the great tradition. Actually, that's Leavis's name for the novels he liked. But there was an equivalent in poetry, you know, this sort of high seriousness, which, of course, includes everybody from, you know, Wordsworth to Eliot, so I'm not denigrating it, but by the middle of the 20th century, it had gotten kind of stiff, and to my taste, boring. So that it was great finding these poets who would who